listening to the Diplomat podcast on Asian geopolitics. As usual, I'm your host, Ankit Panda, an editor at the Diplomat, and I'm happy to be joined today by my colleague, Prashant Parameswaran. Thanks for joining me, Prashant. How's it going today?
Yeah, good. Thanks for having me.
Great. Very happy to have you on. Now, for listeners, this podcast will be part of our ongoing series that we've been doing on the South China Sea, which has been tense for the past few months, indeed the past year. So over the weekend, Indonesia and China had a fairly significant standoff in the South China Sea, in the Natuna Sea, near a disputed area between China's nine-dash line and Indonesia's exclusive economic zone. And I'm particularly excited to be doing this podcast with Prashant, since he's our editor for Southeast Asia and a very close observer of Indonesian politics and foreign and security policy. So, Prashant, before we dig into some of the questions and ambiguities and potential consequences arising from the weekend's incident, I do want to offer some context for our listeners, many of whom might not be familiar with what exactly happened. And for sure, I'm not entirely sure of what happened because the Indonesians haven't released all the details yet. They have been fairly more transparent than some other governments in releasing maps and a chronology of the series of incidents. But here's what happened as I understand it in the South China Sea this weekend. So Indonesia's maritime authorities, one of their ships saw a Chinese fishing vessel, the Kui Fei, approximately 68 nautical miles from the closest Indonesian island in the Natuna Archipelago. And 68 nautical miles is an important measure in the sense that it means that this vessel was inside Indonesia's exclusive economic zone, but it wasn't inside Indonesia's 12 nautical mile territorial sea. Those are designations provided for by the United Nations Convention on the Law of the Sea that determine the varied rights that states have. Territorial seas are comparable to land borders, where states have the full right to exercise security rights within them, and exclusive economic zones generally are generally reserved for economic exploitation and other activities by the state that they belong to. Indonesia and China have had some issues that Prashant can maybe go into more detail about later, where China's nine-dash-line claim in the South China Sea intersects Indonesia's exclusive economic zone. So anyways, the Indonesian authorities spot this fishing vessel. They react. They begin towing it. They arrest the eight-member Chinese crew. They begin towing it back to Natuna Besar, which is the largest island in the Natuna Islands in Indonesia. And on their way back, this is about Saturday night, so Sunday morning at 2 a.m. on their way back to Natuna Besar, the Indonesian Coast Guard vessel and the Chinese fishing vessel that is in tow are intercepted by two Chinese Coast Guard vessels. Now, one of these Chinese Coast Guard vessels then rams the Kui Fei, the fishing vessel, and releases it from the Indonesian authorities. Now, the Chinese fishermen remain in the custody of the Indonesians. But what's notable here is the location at which it happens, and this happens, according to the Indonesians, 4.34 kilometers off of the coast of one of the islands in the Natuna Archipelago, which means that this is inside the territorial sea, which is highly provocative, and that's something that's entirely out of sync with what innocent passage in international law allows for and suggests that we're seeing an unprecedented level of hostility from Chinese Coast Guard vessels towards Indonesian authorities. Now, that's the basic rundown of what happened, and what's interesting here is that Indonesia, while it isn't a claimant in the South China Sea in the sense that it doesn't claim any disputed features, it is an interested party, and it's had this sort of ambiguous approach to China where it has tried to get Beijing to clarify its claims in the southern South China Sea with its nine-dash line and the Natuna Sea. Anyways, I've been talking for a while. Prashant, I want to pass it over to you since you do watch Indonesia quite closely, and, tell us a bit about the context of Indonesia's South China Sea policy. Jokowi obviously has emphasized the global maritime fulcrum and maritime sovereignty. Indonesia's been sinking all these fishing ships. So how does this incident sort of factor into what Indonesia has been doing in the South China Sea for the past couple of years?
Yeah, so I think the place where you started is exactly right, in that, as you mentioned, Chinese intrusions into Indonesia's exclusive economic zone are not new. There have been several incidents in the past, both reported and also unreported over the past few years. But in contrast to this previous spate of incidents, the Indonesian government's publicity in terms of its account of the incident, as well as some of the rhetoric that we've seen compared to its more quiet approach in the past, is really telling of how serious it's taking it. But as you mentioned, it's useful to take a step back and see how this factors into Indonesia's overall South China Sea policy, as well as the Sino-Indonesian relationship more generally. I think there's already an inbuilt lingering Indonesian suspicion of Chinese motives within Sino-Indonesian relations. Recall, Sino-Indonesian relations were basically frozen from 1967 up to 1990 for most of the Cold War. And even when they were normalized, even economic initiatives like the ASEAN-China Free Trade Agreement, which is a good example, were viewed with high suspicion among some in the country. So this has been an issue that's been nagging Indonesia for a number of years. And if you look at Indonesia's South China Sea policy more specifically, since the normalization of ties, there was also already an inbuilt element of suspicion of China due to Jakarta's long-standing concerns on the Natunas. As you mentioned, China's nine-dash line overlaps with Jakarta's exclusive economic zone, which is generated from the Natuna Islands chain, even though Indonesia is not a claimant to the South China Sea disputes. So I've argued that Indonesia's South China Sea policy, we can basically characterize it as sort of a delicate equilibrium. There's a softer edge where Indonesia seeks to engage China and sort of enmesh it into regional institutions with other actors. But there's also a harder edge where Indonesia sought to build up its own capabilities and increase ties with other countries. So that's been something that's been occurring even before Jokowi entered government in late 2014. That being said, since Jokowi's come into power, there's been this tension between his desire to engage China economically. China's one of Indonesia's top trading partners, and it's a key contributor to Indonesia's infrastructure development, and that's where Jokowi wants to take Indonesia. But on the other hand, Jokowi's also been quite resolute on sovereignty issues and also emphasizing this idea that you mentioned earlier, the global maritime fulcrum, positioning Indonesia as a fulcrum between the Indian and Pacific Oceans. And the toughness of Indonesia in the maritime domain, the best example of that is the sort of war on illegal fishing. And in fact, we saw this when last May, Indonesia sunk its first Chinese vessel under the Jokowi administration after much deliberation last year, something which Beijing took note of. And we've also been seeing it in some of the quieter initiatives that Indonesia has been taking thus far, such as those announced towards the middle to late of last year. I'm forgetting the exact month. I think it was September when it announced that it was going to equip the Natunas with additional infrastructure and military capabilities, and potentially even a new base. And as we're seeing now with this incident, we're definitely seeing a tension between Jokowi's desire again to engage China economically, with him wanting to be tough on these sovereignty issues. So that's sort of where we are in terms of the big picture of the Sino-Indonesian relationship.
Thanks, Prashant. That was very succinct and clear. And I guess the question that, I'm left with at least is where does Indonesia go from now and how do things change? I thought it's interesting that the timing of this coincides with Indonesia's own high-level intra-ministry review of the country's South China Sea policy, which is being led by Luhut Panjaitan, one of the country's most prominent ministers. Actually, I was reminded of this by reading a recent piece at CSIS's Asia Maritime Transparency Initiative by Aaron Connolly, but you've been a little bit more skeptical of Indonesia's policy actually changing after this incident. Can you talk about, some of the reasons why we're more likely to see continuity rather than change after this?
Yeah, so I think a more useful way to conceptualize what we're talking about when we sort of try to come to terms with how Indonesia's South China Sea policy will be moving forward is based on the current policy that Indonesia has adopted, which is, sort of a mix of a softer edge where it tries to engage China, it tries to use these regional institutions, but then it also pursues its own balancing, building up its own capabilities. What about this approach specifically will change? Is there anything with respect to these components, how they will be balanced? And I think given what we've seen Indonesia already doing, we're more likely to see an intensification of some of these components rather than a shift or departure dramatically from that overall approach. So I'll give you a couple of examples. One would be, as I mentioned earlier, the Indonesians have started building up their capabilities and infrastructure near the Natunas. And part of this is designed to increase the number of patrols they'll be able to do and also to increase the number of assets they have devoted to, among other things, counter potential Chinese assertiveness in these areas. I think we're going to see a strengthening of that, and some Indonesian officials have already indicated that this will occur. What I think is less certain and will be really interesting to watch is if this leads Indonesia to take a more forward-leaning approach as to how it deals with the South China Sea issue in more regional and international settings.
Right, I was
So,
about
for
to ask.
example, yeah, exactly. So, within ASEAN and other forums, Indonesia has been quite cautious to put it politely, in terms of how it deals with the South China Sea. And this has been a source of frustration for many individuals who watch Indonesia closely. And I should add that part of the reason why Indonesia adopts this very complex balance in its South China Sea policy is not only a function of how it protects its interests, it's also as a function of its specific position. So, for example, Indonesia has not wanted to get formally tied to the issue multilaterally because it feels that that would only legitimize Beijing's claims, and it wants to preserve its status as a non-claimant. And also, the other thing to note that's really key to this, Indonesia's capabilities, even though they're rising and there's been a lot of attention to try to increase them, are very, very limited relative to China. So this idea somehow that we're going to get an Indonesia that's much tougher on China, I think that that's something that Indonesia may consider, and they will consider very specific capability upgrades. But beyond that, I'd be very suspicious about anyone who claims that Indonesia is trying to take on China more directly. And I don't think those who observe Indonesia very closely would suggest that, precisely because they're aware of some of these limitations.
Fantastic. One of the things I wanted to ask you also is, you know, I've been reading these reports and you've been seeing very senior Indonesian officials suggesting that it might consider international arbitration, which I found very surprising because that essentially goes against a lot of what you've been saying. It essentially shows that Indonesia is willing to legitimize its dispute in the Natunas with China, which it has been loath to do for a while. Do you think that's a likely course of action for Jakarta?
Yeah, so I think the issue that you raise gets to why I tend to, when it comes to Indonesia and the South China Sea, pay more attention to what Indonesia is doing rather than what Indonesia is saying. So a number of Indonesian officials, including Luhut, as you mentioned earlier, have been saying for a long time, including from the beginning of the Jokowi administration, very assertive things about the Natunas belonging to Indonesia. Luhut, when Jokowi came over here for his trip to Washington, said something about U.S. freedom of navigation operations that were going on against China, equating them to rising American presence in Afghanistan and Iraq that were not helpful. So Indonesian rhetoric has tended to change and shift and send very confusing signals. So when we look at how Indonesia's South China Sea policy is going to change or not change in the future, we should really look at what Indonesia is doing and what it can do and what its interests are, rather than looking at what some of these officials are saying.
Absolutely. And, you know, kind of zooming out a bit from the Sino-Indonesian aspect of this, you know, looking at how Vietnam and the Philippines are navigating their disagreements with China, both those countries have pursued different approaches. Do you foresee more networking between the actual claimants, the actual ASEAN claimants in the South China Sea, which include Malaysia, Vietnam, Philippines, and Brunei, and Indonesia, either through ASEAN or through other fora? You know, for example, we have the ongoing talks over the code of conduct and other issues like that. Do you see Indonesia taking more of a leadership role now as it's sort of pushed along by these other states and their representatives?
So I think on, that's a very good question. I think on the networking of claimants within ASEAN, officials in the region and beyond have already seen a significant increase in terms of the networking of some of the claimants in the South China Sea. And that is largely a product of China's growing assertiveness. And that has touched not only Vietnam and the Philippines, which have always been the more forward-leaning ASEAN claimants, but also Malaysia, which lies more on the southern part and towards the end of China's nine-dash line claim. And Indonesia is just sort of out on that on the end. In terms of whether Indonesia will play a more of a leadership role on the code of conduct, I think that that remains to be seen. As of now, the Indonesians have not been very strong and active within ASEAN and regional institutions. And the code of conduct, irrespective of who leads it, China's foot dragging is the one that's sort of keeping the ASEAN states from negotiating anything with China. And I've also been careful to emphasize, when it comes to the code of conduct in the South China Sea, that even though it'd be really good to have something legally binding and we should continue to work towards these diplomatic approaches, the reality is that China is changing the realities on the ground, militarily speaking. And countries will have to adapt to that environment, because even though China may eventually sign it in 10, 15, 20 years, the reality on the ground may have changed so significantly such as to make that code of conduct virtually meaningless.
Right. And, you know, let's talk a bit about the Chinese side of this whole dispute with Indonesia and this incident in particular. From my perspective, it looks like this was not an act of, you know, high state policy by China, that this was simply a the Chinese Coast Guard acted on its own accord and pursued the Indonesian Maritime Authority's vessel into the territorial sea. But it is unmistakable that this comes at a time when China has been intensifying its assertiveness. For example, we had the standoff that we discussed on a previous podcast episode at a Jackson Shoal with the Philippines. We've heard reports from senior U.S. officials that China may be gearing up for land reclamation activity at Scarborough Shoal. And obviously in the background here is the impending decision at The Hague in the Permanent Court of Arbitration in Philippines versus China. But, it was interesting that we saw leaked reports that the Chinese Foreign Ministry had contacted Indonesia, begging them not to leak this to the press. And that, to me, is, again, suggestive of the fact that we're seeing the Chinese Coast Guard act on its own accord here. What do you make of the Chinese reaction in all this?
Yeah, I think I'd say two things. One, the concern about the degree to which this is a coordinated incident in terms of the Chinese government or whether it has to do with individual fishing vessels just speaks to how complex these issues are. These gray zone scenarios that are partly a Chinese undertaking. I mean, the Chinese not only have intensified their efforts as a government in terms of their Coast Guard presence, they also live off the fact that some of these issues are very difficult to address, such that naval vessels of these countries, keep in mind, for example, that Indonesia is trying to set up and has in very early stages of setting up a Coast Guard, but it's nowhere near the size of the Chinese Coast Guard. It's very difficult to engage the Chinese on these issues because the Chinese fishermen, even though they're fishermen, it's been proven by a number of regional governments that somehow they have unbelievable access to certain communications devices that no other fishermen in these countries do, and they coordinate very closely with Chinese officials. So this gray zone issue complicates the degree to which we can attribute this to China or not. In terms of the Chinese officials begging Indonesia not to leak the comments out, it does speak to a broader issue, which is the degree to which China is concerned about its reputation or reputational costs in the South China Sea. This, obviously, the Chinese would suffer a reputational cost when these incidents arise. But thus far, the Chinese have also been willing to assume a lot of reputational damage while they preserve and, in fact, maximize their interests in the South China Sea. And that is a good way to link it to the court decision that we're going to see coming up in May or June, because that will very much, if the court does rule, at least partly in the Philippines' favor, which many are expecting, that will affect China's reputation internationally. And how China chooses to deal with that and manages maximizing its interests and also its reputational costs will be a significant thing to watch going forward.
Absolutely, Prashant. And I've said that in the past. I mean, I'm expecting the court to rule mainly in Manila's favor, especially on the legality of the nine-dash line. And, I think I missed this in my recap of the incident, but China's ambassador in Indonesia did say that there was no issue and these fishing men shouldn't have been arrested because they were operating in traditional Chinese fishing grounds. So that at least suggests that, China continues to see the southern reaches of the nine-dash line near the Natunas as its waters. In some sense of the word, China is very careful not to couch its claims in terms of, the actual language of UNCLOS. Okay. But after this ruling, there's no doubt that we'll see how China reacts to negative reputational costs. Mm-hmm. Anyways, Prashant, thanks a lot for your time. I really enjoyed this conversation, and hopefully we'll be able to do more of these going forward on the South China Sea, as matters will no doubt continue to heat up with the impending court decision and more.
Great. Good to be with you.
Absolutely. And for listeners, as usual, if you like this podcast, please leave us a rating on iTunes, and don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss future episodes. Thanks for listening.